What makes you want to go grocery shopping, take a drive, and go snowshoeing? It's not an energy drink, it's today's Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. On our program, we'll step inside a bi-fuel truck, that's one that runs on gasoline and compressed natural gas, to learn more about alternatives to gasoline. And a farmer, writer, and key speaker at a sustainable farming conference argues for buying organic local food in a tough economy. Plus, we'll march across the snowy Laurel Highlands. Please stay tuned for this and more on the Allegheny Front. And we start this week's show with a clip from the documentary film, Who Killed the Electric Car?
Ladies and gentlemen, we are gathered here today to bereave the loss of something dear to us. Some might say that to be here gathered today to mourn the loss of a car would be going too far.
That was from the opening scene of the documentary Who Killed the Electric Car? It explores the making and breaking of General Motors' electric car of the 90s. But you have to wonder what director Martin Sheen would have to say about the new generation of alternative vehicles. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. And Pittsburgh Region Clean Cities is educating individuals and businesses and governments, anybody with big fleets of vehicles, about using alternative fuels, whether that's electric, propane, or natural gas, as in the Ram bi-fuel pickup that Rick Price showed me recently. Rick Price directs Pittsburgh Region Clean Cities. The Ram pickup he's driving runs on gasoline and compressed natural gas, or CNG. Let's take a spin.
If I wanted that to say gas and I wanted it to run on gasoline, I could go and shut the valves off in the back and it would just run on gasoline. Like this morning, I hadn't ran it since Friday. I started up this morning and started on gas, and within a minute, it switched over. You can't tell that at all. Either idling or running down the road, you can't tell any difference.
Do you own this truck?
No, this is a demo that I received from the Chrysler regional manager to basically, as a demo, to run through fleets in the Pittsburgh area to let them try the vehicle.
So what is the advantage?
I'm not going to say that gasoline prices won't go up, but it's never going to go at the same...
You mean CNG?
Of CNG will not go up, but they'll never go at the same delta that the petroleum-based fuels are. And we've seen that over the years. If you have something that just goes on, a refinery breaks down, a conflict in another country over there, it's nothing for our gas to go up 15, 20 cents.
So you're working with the Clean Cities campaign to educate not just individual consumers, but also larger fleets, governments.
Giant Eagle's the leader in this area with 20 of the Class 8 tractors running 100,000 gallons of gasoline gallon savings just in those first 10 trucks they had. I saw last week the Pitt, Ohio has a Class 8 tractor.
Do you expect that alternative fueled vehicles like this will get a boost from the fiscal cliff deal that President Obama signed? It includes various alternative fuel vehicle tax credits.
Oh, yes. Those tax credits giving you the 50%, 50-cent tax credit on propane and natural gas, your dollar on biodiesel, the infrastructure tax credit of up to $30,000 for installing infrastructure. I see all the people that were talking about building natural gas stations probably wanting to do more of those this year, and then you even have the home refueling units. You can get you can get some money for that on the tax credits.
Okay, can we look under the hood?
Sure. Well, I'll show you the back first. This is your refueling nozzle where the gasoline is as well, and this is a high pressure nozzle. There's a locking nozzle that goes over there. Back here is where your storage tanks are for the natural gas. Like I said, it's 18.2 gallon. And so, you know, we need to educate the first responders when we start talking about alternative fuel. So we are doing that as well.
In case there's an accident, they know.
Sure, they need to be, they're usually there before anybody else. They just don't want to treat this like a gasoline vehicle. You want to be able to shut those, isolate the natural gas. One thing good about natural gas is natural gas goes up. Gasoline, propane go down.
Right, natural gas is very light.
Right, right. And then under the hood,
beautiful.
So basically what you have here under the hood, you have things called fuel rails, which are basically rails that run along the engine goes into your gas cylinder. You have a regulator that basically takes the gas from 3,600 pound and brings it down to between 100 and 200 pound to go in there. And then you have your stainless steel high pressure lines that run through there.
The two silver things we're looking at, are those the fuel lines or no?
Because they do look like they're the injector ports. So those are the fuel rails here. That little valve on end, that's a pop-off in case the pressure gets too high. That would release.
Should we take a little ride?
Sure, by all means. There's nothing any different. As you can see, we're running on CNG. And you can see the two gauges where we got a little over half a tank on the gasoline and we have about a half a tank of CNG. Right up here, one of the private investors has bought the old Rennekamp building, and they've run into a little bit of a problem, but they're supposed to be putting a natural gas station in right there on West Carson Street, or at this Exxon station right down here at Station Square. So there's been some people that didn't want the station with, I guess, housing being that close.
I work here, but I don't even know. There's like all these little hidden things that you don't know one of these vehicles.
We were supposed to put a biodiesel station right back behind 7th and A Street. There's a great deal of interest in putting in stations and running vehicles here. You know, we're putting in electric charging stations and plug-in electric vehicles such as the Chevy Volt, where there's tax credits and with the between the state and the federal, we can turn around and have about $11,000 off of these electric and plug-in electric vehicles.
That was Rick Price, director of Pittsburgh Region Clean Cities, one of about 100 organizations that the Department of Energy works with to educate individuals and institutions about alternatively fueled vehicles. Now, onto a story about an individual who's bought his own natural gas car. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has this story from our archives.
Meet Joe Lundy. He lives in Fox Chapel, a leafy suburb of Pittsburgh.
And we'll see how long we can get this to run.
He's got a wife, two kids, and a few cars in the driveway. But look a little more closely. Actually, just look at what he's doing with his car, and you'll find this is no ordinary Joe.
You can hear that little suction. That noise shouldn't be there.
Joe is fueling up his Honda Civic GX. It's a car that runs exclusively on natural gas. He's hooked up a hose from a compressor along the side of his house. It takes gas from his utility line and puts it directly into his car's gas tank.
But that's basically how loud it is. And you can smell you can smell the natural gas a little bit.
Using the compressor, it takes Joe 8 whole hours to refuel his car. So why is he going through all this? Why natural gas? It turns out Joe got the idea at work. He's the CFO of a company that rents out bulldozers and backhoes. A couple years ago, his company started doing a lot of business with oil and gas drillers. They'd come to Pennsylvania to look for natural gas in the Marcellus Shale.
And you start thinking, well, you know, if there's so much natural gas here, from a commuting standpoint, why not try it?
Joe, so far, has been pleased. He's saving about $15 a week on his commute by using natural gas. He also likes that his car is better for the environment. Methane, the main ingredient in natural gas, produces 25% less CO2 than gasoline. It emits fewer of the components that make smog, and it creates virtually no particulate matter. That's the black soot that comes out of the tailpipes of diesel trucks. So is natural gas the fuel of the future? Joe Lundy says it should be.
It's cleaner, it's cheaper, and it's abundant, and it's domestic. Why not? And try it.
Natural gas cars have caught on in parts of Europe, South America, and Asia, but there are only 120,000 of the vehicles in this country. And most of these are so-called fleet vehicles, like dump trucks and buses. Only one passenger car sold in the U.S. runs on natural gas. That's Joe's Honda Civic. The car costs about $25,000, $6,000 more than a regular Civic. Even if you're willing to pay more, you have to find a dealer that will sell you one. Joe found his in Buffalo. New York is one of only four states where the car is sold. But that still leaves the question of refueling. Joe paid $3,000 for his used natural gas compressor.
The gentleman I bought it from, he said these things are like little tanks. They just never break, right, which I kind of throw back at him now because it really hasn't worked like he said it was going to work from the beginning.
Once you get on the road, natural gas filling stations are few and far between. There are hundreds in California, but Pennsylvania, for instance, has only 10. And most of these are in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, as Joe and his son found out when they drove across the state this summer.
We're going to take our van or one of the other cars, and my 12-year-old, Vince, said, "Dad, let's take the Honda." I said, "Well, Vince," I said, "we got to plan this out." He said, let's do it.
Part of the plan was a two-hour detour each way to State College, the only place between the two cities with a natural gas filling station. This lack of refueling options is the central issue for natural gas vehicles, says Amy Myers Jaffe of Rice University.
We have a chicken and egg problem in this country if we did talk about going off of gasoline.
Even if the industry solves its chicken and egg dilemma, environmental questions linger. It may have cleaner emissions, but natural gas is still a fossil fuel. And when it burns, it emits carbon dioxide, the main culprit in global climate change. It is also increasingly derived from fracking. The industry says fracking, if done right, is safe. But some environmentalists, like Amy Mall of the National Resources Defense Council, say fracking can contaminate groundwater and make people near the wells sick.
Natural gas is not clean, and producing natural gas is not clean, but it may be cleaner than other alternatives.
Joe, for one, is in favor of drilling. He thinks it can be done safely. As for his Honda, it's been a hit with his son, Vince.
It's something just special about it.
So do any of the other kids at his school have a car like his dad's?
No.
Well, not maybe.
Maybe.
I don't think so.
But I doubt that.
When Vince is old enough to buy his own car, there's a chance it will run on natural gas. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
We first aired that story in 2011. We checked in with Joe Lundy this week. He tells us he's now got 20,000 plus miles on the Civic. Lundy's other son, Jack, is now 16, and he's also driving it and enjoying paying just $11 to fill her up. You're listening to the Allegheny Front. Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection just announced that the Susquehanna River is not going to be added to the state's list of impaired rivers. Sounds like a good thing, right? Not so, says the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission. They say the DEP is in denial about the quality of the Susquehanna's water. The Allegheny Front's Anne Murray has more about this tale of battling agencies and the fish caught in the middle.
John Arway, the director of the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission, is not your typical bureaucrat. He points fingers when he thinks something's wrong. And he thinks the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection is dead wrong about its assessment of a 100-mile stretch of the Susquehanna River. That's where young smallmouth bass, one of the most popular sport fish in America, are turning up with lesions and sores, causing them to die and not repopulate the river. Here's the gist of the problem, according to Arway.
The principal phenomenon that we're seeing going on in the river is these excessive algae blooms, depressing oxygen levels at night, increasing pH levels during the day, causing these stressful conditions to these fish, which then get infected by bacteria that eventually kill them.
Fish and Boat has spent $500,000 studying the die-off. Their research points to stressors including low oxygen levels, warmer water temperatures, and growing rates of phosphorus in the Susquehanna. But the DEP questions,
if water quality has anything to do with why these bass are having these issues.
DEP spokesman Kevin Sunday calls Fish and Boat's findings sparse, and their call for declaring the Susquehanna impaired premature, An impairment designation under the Federal Clean Water Act would require the state to create a plan to eliminate pollutants.
The Fish and Boat came to us with four pieces of data, and they asked us, based on four pieces of data, to impair a 98-mile stretch of river, and that's very questionable from a scientific standpoint.
Fish and Boat says they submitted, quote, several years' worth of data that meet DEP's standard for an impairment listing. The quantity and quality of Fish and Boat's data aren't DEP's only objection to placing the river on the impairment list. The agency likes to point out that only young smallmouth bass are dying in the Susquehanna.
No other aquatic life or plant life appears to be impacted.
But John Arway isn't buying that argument.
I really liken that to, you know, if we had a portion of the population of single white males less than 25 years old in Harrisburg being affected by a disease, we're not going to do anything until everybody else in the population gets infected by the same disease.
That's not to say that DEP isn't studying the problem. This summer, the agency did water quality studies on six rivers, including six sites on the Susquehanna, and will work with Fish and Boat and others. All agency squabbling aside, longtime fishing guide Max McAllister just wants some action on the part of the state. He's been taking people out on the Susquehanna to fish for smallmouth bass for more than 20 years. And he's losing his customers.
It has been a negative impact over the last probably 5-6 years, getting calls from literally all over the country. Absolutely, it has affected our business 40-60%.
The fishing industry brings billions of dollars into Pennsylvania, so the state has a lot to lose if smallmouth bass disappear from the Susquehanna. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Ann Murray.
Twenty-something farm hippies, as well as the old guard of this type, will gather with Amish folk, foodies, and others for the 22nd year in a row as the Pennsylvania Association of Sustainable Agriculture Conference gets underway. This alternative farm show kicks off Wednesday in State College. Ben Hewitt kind of falls into the youngish farm category. He runs a family plot in Vermont and writes about sustainable ag. He's a speaker at the conference, and he's on the phone now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jennifer.
Ben, what kind of farm do you have, and is it hopping today?
Yeah, we've got quite a menagerie. We run about, depending on the time of year, anywhere between like a half dozen and maybe 10 cows/beef animals. Right now we have just a couple of pigs, but we do about 10 to a dozen pigs annually. We have a pick-your-own blueberry patch. We have a few sheep that are bordering on pets. So it's, everything we do is on a very modest scale. It's hyper diversified, and we really view the farm as sort of a living entity ecosystem unto itself.
You've written two books, The Town That Food Saved, and the other is Making Supper Safe. Do you have a 1-minute elevator speech about The Town That Food Saved?
Sure. The Town That Food Saved sort of chronicles the efforts of a group of sort of agripreneurs, I term them, in the town of Hardwick, Vermont, to sort of implement a regionalized food system. And it also looks at, the dairy farmers, the itinerant slaughterers in the region, and this sort of looks at how all of these people are contributing to this system.
We are well into the era of food writer Michael Pollan, writer of Omnivore's Dilemma. So there's a lot of writing out there about sustainable agriculture and food. It must be tough to bring something new on this topic to the table. So tell me what are you bringing to the Ag Conference?
Yeah, that's a great, I really appreciate that question, actually. When I'm looking at all of these issues around food, and I'm sort of wondering, why do the same challenges sort of keep cropping up? And this is particularly sort of poignant in relation to local food systems, where, just the issues of accessibility and producer viability keep coming up over and over and over. And, my recognition that food and the way we look at food and the way we interact with food has a lot to do with the way we interact with money. It has a lot to do with our political system. It has a lot to do with our healthcare system. And so, what I'm trying to do, or what I'm interested in doing right now in my in my work is, you know, not so much food specific, but trying to look at sort of the underlying factors that created the food systems that we have today.
Speaking of, money, I was seeing some coverage after your book came out, The Town That Food Saved, about some, I think they were high school students in their English class studying your book, and a kid who worked at a local grocer and was like, no, this book is just way off base because people can't afford that.
Well, I mean, you know, in one sense, he's absolutely right. You know, in another sense, I would argue that people can't afford not to afford it.
We should say that it we're talking about is, you know, buying locally.
Right. Yeah, I assume that's what you meant. Yeah. And I have to say, one of the reasons I was so intrigued with looking at the town of Hardwick is because it's a town of sort of below average financial means. So the median income in Hardwick is about $15,000. And so, you know, when you have a situation where you've got a parent who's working two jobs, you know, just to keep any food on the table, you know, how do you tell that person, you know, well, you know, really, it'd be so much better for you and for your community if you were buying this sort of local, sustainable, organic,
artisanal cheese.
Artisanal cheese, right, for $20 a pound. You know, that's a really hard pill to swallow. I guess that, you know, and it's one of the reasons, again, you know, that I'm sort of compelled to look beyond the food system at sort of the underlying factors that make that person unable to support a regionalized food system that makes a lot of sense in so many ways.
And I have to play this clip from Portlandia. Do you know the one I'm going to play?
No, I don't.
About
I don't
the chicken?
I'm not familiar with the show,
you
but yeah.
You are not. Okay. All right. You have to listen to this.
Okay.
If you have any questions about the menu, please let me know.
I guess I do have a question about the chicken, if you could just tell us a little bit more about it.
The chicken is a heritage breed, woodland-raised chicken that's been fed a diet of sheep's milk, soy, and hazelnuts.
Okay, this is local?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local?
It is.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board, organic.
So,
all right, I get the point. Yeah, you know, and it's a great clip because it exemplifies exactly one point I would really like to make. You know, the reason we need all of these labels is because we have so little transparency in our food system. Mm. And you really only need that sort of level of labeling and regulation when you don't have transparency. And so all of these labels, you know, they arise out of this place of this tremendous separation between us and our food. So we come up with all these terms to sort of, you know, try to make ourselves feel good about what we're putting into our bodies. And, you know, that's important. I mean, you're putting this stuff in your body, right?
Mm-hmm.
To my way of thinking. And again, this is a very difficult thing to say to someone who's struggling to put any food on the table. But, you know, food is the last thing that should be cheap.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Sure.
This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. Ben Hewitt is on the phone. He's a writer and farmer in Vermont, and he'll be speaking at the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture Conference on Saturday. More information at AlleghenyFront.org. We've been featuring winter outdoor memories in recent weeks on the Allegheny Front. One of our reporters took her first steps in snowshoes last weekend with Venture Outdoors. The Pittsburgh nonprofit has been leading outside adventures since 2001. The Allegheny Front's Ashley Murray headed to the Laurel Highlands with Venture Outdoors' Bill Grove and Katie Getze, as well as other snowshoe novices.
The toe pick is for going downhill or uphill. It allows you to dig in, grab a hold of the snow. The next bigger cleat that you see right here is underneath the forefoot.
So I'm in Rockwood, PA, snowshoeing with about 20 people. It's a beginner snowshoeing trek, as they call it, snowshoeing 101. And we are just starting out on the trail.
My name's Tom Cosgrove. I'm an assistant trip leader on this trip. We are going to be walking around Camp Soul. We're just going to be doing a big loop around this lake. I'm thinking around two-ish miles. How you doing so far with the snowshoes?
I think I'm doing okay. Yeah, oh boy, just slid a little there. Yes, spoke too soon.
All right.
And what's your name?
Elizabeth Engelman. Call me Lizzie. In many situations, I'm Engelwoman. I'm a longtime Pittsburgh resident, and I'm a Southern gal from Florida. And for 32 years, I've hated winter. I decided this year, I'm going to like it. And practically broke my neck to get here today, worked till 3 this morning.
Oh my God.
But I wasn't going to miss this. And I'm hooked. It will be snowshoe for me forever.
Well, you look like a natural already.
Oh, thanks. Fake it till you make it. Well, I hope you're having fun.
I am. This is very fun.
Because this is a hoot.
So we're walking along the trail still. We're getting deeper into the woods. It's just really gorgeous, really quiet. The trees are covered in snow. The only sound you hear are just the quiet conversations of the participants on this hike.
In the snow, we want to look at the terrain. You'll see where the tree hump is. You'll see where the snow is covered to rock.
Can you talk about the appeal of snowshoeing? I mean, as far as I can tell so far, and this is only my first time, it seems like a pretty safe winter activity. I mean, I've been skiing once before, and it was pretty terrifying.
Well, you're talking about a sport that everybody can do. It's low impact. You can make it as aerobic as you want. It's up to you. You're not going to fall going 50 miles an hour. You know, our mission is to get people outside to enjoy the natural resources of the area. And that's what we're doing.
We're really beginner friendly, which is great. It gives people a way to get outside when, you know, maybe they'd be uncomfortable doing something. Like today, we had snowshoes for everybody. You know, you don't have to go and buy them and make a big purchase. You can just try it and see if it's something you like to do.
I'm Doreen.
Doreen?
Karis. I've been wanting to try snowshoeing for a long time. My family skis. I'm unable to do that. I've got very arthritic knees. So I thought, well, I can walk. I should be able to do this. So my choices are sit around in the lodge, read a book, or go to the spa, or stay at home. This is much better than all of those things. Although the spa's a nice trip too.
And we are about to end the hike, but it is uphill to the car. So, yes, it is wearing me out. From Rockwood, PA, on a snowshoeing hike, I'm Ashley Murray for the Allegheny Front.
Ashley Murray's trip was led by Bill Grove and Katie Getze of Venture Outdoors. For pictures of Ashley and other snowshoe novices, please go to AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to our program. If it's too cold to go outside, write us a letter about how you're staying warm. Or just wait 24 hours and the temperature will probably swing up 50 degrees. Either way, find us on your smartphone or laptop at AlleghenyFront.org. We're hearing lots of good things about our new website. We think you'll enjoy the sights and sounds. Naturally, we also tweet on Twitter and post on Facebook. Janelle Pfeiffer is our social media empress, as well as our production director. Kathy Nauer is the Allegheny Front's executive producer. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. Join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
The Allegheny Front is supported by the Heinz Endowments, the Remmel Foundation, administered by PNC Charitable Trusts, the Laurel Foundation, and the A.D. and J.W. Wilson Fund of the Pittsburgh Foundation.